Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and this is Rick Johnson, the host of Paul Revere Radio, and we are once again going to give a good attempt at having a show today for you. If Blog Talk Radio will cooperate with us, I've been having some computer problems this afternoon, but we have a very special guest. Our guest is Pastor Gregory Williams, and he is out on the West Coast, so it's still mid-afternoon for him. He has an excellent website. I would encourage you to visit. It's hisholychurch.org. All one word, hisholychurch.org. He's a frequent contributor to News with Views. That's where I first started reading his information. And we want to get right into it. Welcome, sir. Pastor Gregory, thank you for being here with us.
I'm glad to be here.
I often state to my friends and family that the best part of this radio program actually happens before we ever go on the air, when I'm sitting and talking with the guests before we get a chance to go on the air. And we've already had a great 10 or 15 minute discussion, but I want to go back and just basically talk about some of the things that we were talking about, and then just kind of play it by ear and see which way our chat room goes and things of that nature. You have an excellent article, and like you said to me before, it started out as being one article, but it's turned into four, and the article's called Do Christians Have the Right to Self-Defense? And when I first saw the title, I was very excited, because I've been doing research and on my own about some of the things that I saw violence in the church. And there are great articles. Anyone who's out there who is interested in looking at this can Google just the term violence against America's churches, and you come up with a host of different things. And for instance, since 1999 to the year 2009, the average of church violence has risen dramatically. But when I actually started reading your articles and got into it, that's really not what you're talking about, as far as I can tell. It's more along the lines of our rights as individuals and the rights of people in the church to defend each other in brotherly love. Would you agree, or am I just totally off the track here?
No, that's we not only have a right to self-defense and defending others and the weak and the poor and the needy, anybody who needs help, we have an obligation, because as I see rights are correlative to obligations, or, their responsibilities. I always say, if you want your rights back, you have to take back your responsibilities. And all our rights, they're not endowed by the Constitution. They're not endowed by some contract. Our rights are endowed by our Creator. That's where they come from. They don't come
Absolutely.
From anything. If it comes from a contract or an agreement, it's a privilege. It's a benefit. It's not something that is really a right. We use that word way too loosely as a right. But, yeah, we not only have a right to self-defense, we have a responsibility to defend ourselves. And Christ said many things along this line. So did, obviously, Moses. The Bible is just full of information about our right and responsibility to protect one another.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And I've just, over the course of the last few days, gone over your article again and again, reading it, and I've highly encouraged others to go out and look it up. But I want to just go right through your very first paragraph. It says, the ancient right to bear arms has been described in antiquity as the obligation to bear arms in defense of your community. In those ancient times, if you were not arm yourself or defend your community, you were often shunned, if not run out of town altogether. Wasn't it also true with the founding of our nation, with the original colonies? There were some colonies in some states basically that said you have to have a firearm and you have to keep it in good working order. when did we turn the page on that and start allowing the government to be the protector and the keeper of our safety and security?
You know, that's you know, of course, these pages, they seem to turn over a period of time. You can't, and it usually takes at least a generation, maybe more. But certainly within the last 25 to 50 years, the more we have, which is absolutely appalling to the early Americans, the more we have looked to government to protect us against hunger, old age, disability, you know, everything. You know, the mindset in the American population now is a very socialistic mindset where the government's supposed to provide and take care of everything. And that was completely the reverse. If you go back, we have up on the website one of the few articles we have by somebody else, and it's the story of Davy Crockett and his refusal in Congress to vote for extra money to be given to a widow because he said that wasn't the purpose of government, to have this. He said, I'll take money out of my pocket, but I don't have the right to take money out of everybody else's pocket. And somewhere along the line, the government has switched our thinking as people has switched to thinking that the government has that responsibility. Well, if the government has the responsibility to protect you against all those things, it has the right to regulate your life from one end to the other. And so it's been a gradual process in the sense of you know, one individual's life, but it's been about one generation it's taken to switch the thinking of Americans. And I suppose big jump was with FDR, you know, where they started thinking that the government is going to solve whatever economic problem has come along, even though the government was probably more instrumental in creating it.
Right. I think FDR took a recession or a correction in the economy and turned it into a major depression. But
yeah, there was a recession shortly before that in 1929 that was actually a bigger drop in markets, and we recovered in almost 6 months. But the difference between that one and the one that we had in 29 was the government decided to help out, and as soon as they did that, the recession stretched out for a much longer period of time. And I'm afraid we're going to see that again.
Yeah, you couldn't tell my grandmother that FDR was a socialist or that his policies were negative policies that were causing more harm than good. And up until the day she died just a few years ago, she would walk into the voting booth and pull the Democratic lever because she felt that FDR, the Democrat Party, saved her family and saved the nation from this terrible depression. And it's unfortunate, but when I would speak to her on individual issues, you know, Grandma, what do you think about this? Or Grandma, what do you think about that? Her issues were far from what the Democrat Party of today would be advocating, but it was, you know, it was just a shame that I never could get her to understand that her views and the views of the Democrat Party were not generally the same view. And socialist is refreshing to hear somebody actually put that out there.
The power of a good PR man is unbelievable. So once you get people to shift their thinking in a particular direction, it's very hard to get them to turn around and go back. And I'm afraid that's what's happened to America. The population of America doesn't think the way early Americans did. People who are moving to become constitutionalists or even go back to constitutional party or what have you, they're not in the same world. They do not really think. You can't really get into the mind of those early Americans unless you walk in their shoes. And that's one of the things when that started me on the particular direction that I've been going for the last 30 years is raising my own children and them studying men like George Washington and their early founders. I asked them to do a report, and I thought, well, this is kind of a shallow report. And I discovered I didn't know who these guys were. I had to go back and actually read the writings that these men wrote themselves, the letters they wrote themselves, to begin to understand who these men were and what they were actually thinking. Because you can't tell from modern history books.
Oh, absolutely not. Like we were speaking before we went on the air, we homeschooled our two boys, and we tried very hard to not use a history book that was written prior to 1960. History books written in the 70s when I went through high school, in the 80s, and then I started teaching high school and looking at curriculum in the that's being used today, they're ridiculous. I mentioned before that you had to know the today to graduate, you basically have to know the top three. You have to know George Washington, but all you need to know about him is that he chopped down a cherry tree. You have to know Jefferson, but all you really need to know about Jefferson in the past is that he was a deist. And then you need to know Franklin, and you just needed to know that he was an alcoholic womanizer. And if you knew those facts, you're probably going to pass most of the curriculum for American history in today's high schools. And it just drove me crazy because they didn't touch the big some of the guys that are more reserved or we don't hear much about, like George Mason, who's considered the father of the Bill of Rights. You know, we talk about defending ourselves and weapons of the Second Amendment. George Mason wrote, what is the militia? It is the whole people, and to disarm the people is the best and most effectual way to enslave them. I guarantee you, if you pick up a standard history book in my state here in North Carolina, you will not find that quote written anywhere in there, and it's tragic.
Yeah.
It's such a fundamental...
I'm not going to take that bet.
No, I...
Because I think you're absolutely right.
Pretty well given. You were talking about, you know, we just don't have a mindset of the colonialists and the early American founders. Here's a fact that I didn't know until very recently. It says here in 1619, the colony of Virginia had statutes that required everyone to bear arms. You didn't have a choice. It was the law. You know, unlike today where we have laws that say you can't bear arms, or if you do bear arms, you have to do them this way, that way, and they just put it down flat. You got to carry a weapon, and it has to be in good functioning order, and you have to have it with you at all times. Connecticut law in 1650 required every man above the age of 16 to possess a good musket or other gun fit for service. Could you imagine if a state today passed a law like that?
Well, actually, a town right near here passed a law like that, and they didn't say musket. They said you had to have a gun. They're not enforcing it, but they actually, the town council passed a law that you were required to own a gun. So,
what was their reaction? Okay, go ahead.
You actually have to also understand statutes are even our opinion and perspective on law, our perspective on what the Constitution actually did and didn't do. We have been literally brainwashed. I don't know if it was exceptionally a some sort of conspiracy, but our thinking has changed because of mass education. If you change the books just a little bit, everybody starts thinking in a particular way, and that's a really dangerous thing. But those first statutes were actually the first statutes passed in America were in 1619, and it actually states that they were the first statutes passed against based on known law. Statutes themselves are not law. Statutes are a verbalization of what you believe the law to be. They're not necessarily binding in the sense of a contract unless you have a contract with the colony. And that's what they were actually doing. They already knew that you could go back to 1400s, 1500s. You couldn't live in certain villages in England unless you armed yourself. And that just came from previous laws that go back when we were using bows and arrows, that you were expected to defend your community. If you didn't, you were considered an outcast. And, you know, you were asking about violence in the churches. That is really a non-issue with anybody who is really being a Christian. It's like, how do we stop people from hijacking airplanes? Well, arm the pilots. What about people who get on with box cutters? Well, hand a box cutter to everybody who gets on as they get on the plane. And
so if we all had box cutters, we wouldn't have to worry about it because there would be a deterrent.
Yeah, there absolutely would. Nobody would try to hijack that plane.
Right.
Shortly after 9/11, somebody
well,
with a dark...
No, go ahead, please.
someone of a dark complexion tried to go to the restroom, and somebody thought he was hijacking the plane, and they jumped him. I mean, the reality is, if you've got 300 people on a plane, three guys are not going to hijack that plane, or five guys, or six guys, or 10 guys aren't going to hijack that plane if we all meet them equally. And it's the same way Israel had problems with terrorists breaking into schools and taking over schools and holding people hostage. They just told all the teachers, bring your gun to school. And it stopped. Overnight, it stopped. Just ended.
Yeah, well, our schools today are just great big huge soft targets, just open cherry picking for terrorists, and so are the churches by and large, because you know we have a population, or we have a group there that you know by and large, if you walked in with a weapon, you're going to be one of the only ones with the weapon. And so
you may be going to the wrong church.
Yeah, well, that very well may be, but I taught at a school where I absolutely knew that I was outgunned by the students. Because the school would not let me carry a weapon, but I knew that there were students who were carrying weapons. Now, not all were walking around with firearms, but I knew that there were kids who were carrying guns and knives, and I've been told, well, you should have turned them in. Well, that's really, you know, nice on the surface, but as one young lady told me, I carried this because I saw it in her purse. She dropped her purse and a knife came out, and I took her to the side, and I was talking to her, and I said, you know, why are you carrying that? And she lit, and I won't use the name of the street, but I'll make one up. She says, I live on Hager Street. Well, being new in that community, I said, you know, I wasn't fair. I said, okay, fine. What does that mean? She said, trust me, you wouldn't walk down Hager Street without some kind of weapon. I'm not going to either. And that made sense to me. And so I told her, I said, okay, just put it away. I don't want to ever see it again. But, you know, the idea that we have a populace that has given up its responsibility for protecting itself and given that responsibility to the government, that spills over into so many different parts of our society, not just the right to self-defense, but, you know, who's going to feed me? Who's going to clothe me? Who's going to defend me? And it's just we have become, I think, a nation where we're dependent on the government for every breath we take, and it's a very dangerous place to be, because then the government can say, okay, I'm not going to allow you to take that breath.
Right.
How do we get back?
Well, you know, I always tell people all roads lead to Rome, all roads lead to the kingdom of heaven. It just depends upon the direction you're going. And that's what the gospel started with, is repent, turn around. And that's what repent means, to turn around, to go another way. We can see how we got this way. I mean, even public schools, everybody's complaining about the socialism showing up in the modern government regime that is now running things in America. The reality is public school is socialism. Social Security is socialism. Back in the days of early America, your church was the entire social welfare system in your community. And it was run and operated entirely by free will offerings given in faith, hope, and charity, and ministered by people who were truly titular servants of the community. Today, we are absolutely the reverse of that. Government does everything. I don't know what the churches are doing. They're singing and they're preaching this eschatology or that eschatology. And none of that is like what was going on in the early church, which I've written 5 books on the subject, about what that early church was actually doing. And if the churches today were doing what that early church was doing, America would still be a free country today.
We would not have our rights.
Say again.
I agree with you 100% on what you're saying. I grew up in a very, very small community in Tennessee with a church that was the only focal social point for the entire community. And the church had no support. Matter of fact, the pastor would preach on Sunday, then on Monday, if the wheat crop was coming in or if the hay crop was coming in, he was out in the field helping us bring in the hay or bring in whatever crop And that's how he got much of his pay was through barter, and because the congregation really couldn't raise enough money to support him and his family. So, you know, if you had wheat coming in, then you gave him part of the wheat, or, you know, he would come out and help and things like that. But even discipline in the community centered through the church. And if someone's family was, maybe the breadwinner was ill, the church helped take care of that. We didn't have a welfare system. We didn't have a food stamp system that I ever remember when I was a kid. People went to the church. The church helped feed the community, helped clothe the community. And I guess, you know, if there was a direct threat in the community, would have helped defend the community. And
The people who are in the church itself are the defenders of the community. If everybody in the community was literally armed. One of the articles talks about this pseudo-pacifism where, and I've known personally, people say, oh, well, I would never own a gun. Like, somehow or other, that makes them holier person. And I says, well, would you call a policeman? And if someone was breaking in, they said, oh, yes. And I says, well, then you believe in guns. You're just too lazy or too irresponsible to handle one. Because you're not calling that policeman because he has a badge. You're calling that policeman because he has a gun.
If he just came running to your house with a badge and a whistle, he wouldn't do you much good.
That's right. And the reality is if you want, I think there should be a law in every community that says if you refuse to own a gun, you should have to put a sign out in front of your house, this is a gun-free zone. This is a gun-free house.
I saw a great sign and a great, actually, the YouTube debate between a right to self-defense and a right to bear arms advocate and a person who was anti-gun. And the gentleman finally said, okay, here, let's do an experiment. I'll put a sign in my front yard that says, nothing here worth dying for. And you put one in your front yard that says, no weapons found here. And let's do this experiment for 6 months, then we'll come back and talk about the right to keep and bear arms. Well, you know, that's a crazy argument. That's a perfect argument, and it works fine, and it makes a lot of sense. Let me ask you a question. Did the church give up its authority and hand it to the government, or did the government come in and take it?
Oh, most of them they gave up their responsibilities. The church has become impotent. It does not take care of the people, and most people don't read this in the Bible. But it's in, you know, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Jesus is giving instructions to his apostles about the church or what the church is supposed to be doing. It says, you're not to be like the governments of the Gentiles, the princes of the Gentiles, who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority one over the other. In other words, the government of the United States doesn't give you anything free, doesn't give you any benefits, doesn't, you know, 40 million Americans are on food stamps. That's not charity, because they're not giving you anything that they did not already take away from your neighbor, maybe legally through taxation, but still they're taking from your neighbor to provide you. So that's not charity. The church operates on faith, hope, and charity in what Paul calls the perfect law of liberty. It takes care of one another through that system of faith, hope, and charity. And that creates bonds in society that just don't go away. Like your mother or your grandmother who thought FDR was great because she got all this stuff from FDR.
Right.
He saved her.
My grandmother.
But FDR didn't give anything to her.
I would say FDR, yeah, he did not reach in his pocket and pull out a 20 and give it to my grandmother. You're absolutely right.
He got that from your neighbor, and he got it by exercising authority. Jesus said it was not to be that way with us. So the church gives up its authority when it gives up its responsibility. And then it did other things that were really stupid. It wanted to get benefits, so it went and incorporated. It went and filed 1023s with the IRS and became strictly regulated. It didn't have to. There's no law requirement. As a matter of fact, on the form itself says churches don't have to file this. But when you make those agreements with these agencies, you give up more and more of your so-called rights that now become privileges and can be taken away by these agencies. We need to get back to what the early Americans were doing and start doing for ourselves. And we've been doing that across the country, around the world, is trying to encourage local congregations to start taking back their responsibilities. It's not demanding your rights. You won't need to if you take back your responsibilities. Because personally, I think that the direction the governments of the world are going today, they're going to let people down in very hard times. We've seen it in things like Katrina and other disasters that have fallen us, that the governments are incapable of handling these dramatic events in society. You need to form local communities. We don't have that anymore. People get raped in the streets, and people close their blinds. They shut their doors, and they do nothing. That is not America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And that has changed from what we used to be. And we need to start changing back. And those people who are willing to make that change back need to start coming together.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Brother Gregory Williams. His website is hisholychurch.org. All one word, hisholychurch.org. And it's an excellent website full of great information. Brother Gregory, we are a little over halfway, and I know that there was another topic that you wanted to get into, and I really do think it ties right into what we're talking about, the government taking over the responsibilities from the individual and the church. And I think it is going to come back to bite them because of this particular problem that we were discussing before we went on the air. Let's talk about the wheat situation and the famines that are probably coming in the near future because of the government policies on storage of wheat. You were explaining to me earlier. Go ahead and go over it again just a little bit.
Yeah, I've got another article coming on News of Views. I sent it in a while ago, and they didn't get it up right away. Everybody on our network, they read it ahead of time, but we told them that wheat prices were going to go up because we could see it. I'm in contact with people all over the world. I used to work on wheat farms 40 years ago in North Dakota. I had relatives. My mom grew up on one. So I went out there to experience that one summer. And there was 6 years' supply of wheat in silos on the farms all over this country for the whole country. It was a government policy to buy that wheat when the price was going down. It would go down when there was bumper crops. And they would buy it at a given amount, and you would store it on your farm in, you know, approved silos. And then when the price started going back up again, when there were shortages, bad crops, whatever, or middle of the winter, you could buy it back from the government at a slightly more low rate of interest and sell it and make a profit. Well, this kept farmers healthy, kept them in good stead, and kept this huge reserve in America, which made America strong and independent. Nixon changed those policies. Other presidents, I don't want to pick on just poor Nixon, but other presidents continued to change those policies. And I've been telling people for several years there's only 6 months' supply of wheat that we would be using in silos in America. Well, I revised that in the recent article that there was 32 days' supply of grain in the pipeline worldwide for the needs of the world. That means that if you have crop failures, major crop failures in the world, you're going to run out of food for the whole world.
Now, Brother Gregory, when I go online here and I do a search on just wheat shortage, I see articles in the New York Times and then the Washington Post that say there is no wheat shortage, but prices may rise. And Reuters...
Well, I can tell you why they say that. They say there's no wheat shortage because we still have 32 days supply. See, we're in a global economy.
They're not looking at the fact that we used to have years' worth of supply, and now we have literally days' worth of supply.
Our margin of surplus is gone from 6 years to 30 days. That's, you know, that is just not a good, safe way to be. grain is one of those interesting commodities. I mean, you can go produce a lot of different kinds of foods, and you can do it fairly quickly in a global economy. You know, they're growing wheat down in Australia or South Africa or Brazil when we're in the middle of the winter and we're not growing any wheat. So that's what's happened. We've gone to this global economy. We just shifted around wherever we need it. And that works great until there is a global disaster in the weather where there's a shortage. Soviet Union just closed its doors to exports. All the countries that depended on Soviet exports for their grain aren't going to get any. They're going to have shortages. Now, we're having a bumper crop here in America. We planted about 30% less than we normally do, so the bumper crop still isn't going to be as much as we would normally get. We're not going to run out of bread tomorrow. We're not going to run out of wheat tomorrow. But we're teetering on the edge of disaster because of the fact that we don't have any surplus. You go back to the time of Joseph in Egypt, they put up 7 years' supply of extra grain because that's the beauty of grain. You can store it for 20 years and still use it. You can't do that with potatoes.
Right. Do we? Yeah, absolutely not. You try storing potatoes like that, and you're just going to have some really nasty
problems. You barely get through 1 year. So that's the beauty of grain, and it allows to protect us from that famine. It's money in the bank, so to speak. And the governments thought, you know, a few years ago, thought it was a great idea to have that surplus. People all over the world thought it was a great idea. But there's not as much money in it. It's a global economy. The traders make lots of money, so everybody moved to that. This is insane thinking. We should, if your government won't do it, then you need to be the government of the people, for the people, and by the people, and you need to supply that surplus within your own community and encourage your own community to store up a certain amount of dry goods that will keep. If it's just for a hurricane someday or that bad winter storm or a trucker strike, people need to start thinking to be responsible for themselves because you are in a very, extremely, very vulnerable position.
One of the quotes on my Facebook page, and it's a joke, but it's still an interesting thought. It says, I talked to my stockbroker yesterday and asked him what I should buy, and his quick reply was canned food and ammo. And so that makes you wonder about the stock market. But, you know, I used to live out in Nevada where there was a very large Mormon population, and they advocate so strongly the family needs to have X amount of food, and I believe it was 1 year supply of food in storage. And if you went online to Yahoo or YouTube or several other places and just did a search on Mormon food storage, you find thousands of references of ways to do that. But, you know, we've gotten away from that. My grandmother had a pantry, and she had canned goods. And all summer we were canning corn and canning green beans and canning all this stuff to have it there for hard times. And we've become dependent on the grocery store. And then if the grocery store failed, I think in the back of our minds is this idea that, don't worry, the government's going to come in and save us. Well, that may have been true when the government had 6 years' worth of wheat. But if the government only has 30 days' worth of wheat, we're going to get biscuits for about 2 weeks, and that's going to be it. Then what's going to happen?
That's right. Now, that's 32 days worldwide supply. That's worldwide supply. So, I mean, the whole world will start going hungry. But I don't want to be too doom and gloom. I'm just saying that we need to start thinking about being responsible for ourselves. I happen to live 100 miles from town. We live way out in the middle of nowhere in the high deserts. And so we don't go to the grocery store for food anyway. So by the circumstances of our lifestyle, we live on a farm. We put up our own food because that's what our circumstances have required. We also see the wisdom of that. We get better food, healthier food, less additives in our food. So our children are all over 6 foot tall. we don't get sick like other people get sick. But the reality is in the cities, people began to shop for tonight's dinner on the way home from work.
Right.
That's insane. That is, you know, we need to start thinking more responsibly and not expect the government, because it won't be there. They've had a pipeline break back there in the East Coast. I think it was Maryland, and you couldn't drink the water without boiling it. And suddenly all the stores emptied out of all bottled water, juices, everything.
You want to see an example of that, just have the weatherman here say the word snow. You know, now you in Oregon, I know that's a joke, but here in South Carolina, and in North Carolina, you just say the word snow. It doesn't have to have snow. Just have the weatherman say there's a possibility of ice or snow, and there won't be a loaf of bread, and even the ugly things. I mean, about the only thing that's left on the shelf are beets. I mean, you know, they'll clear out a grocery store.
But if you had a real disaster, you have a real disaster.
We had one of my favorite lesson plans that I like to teach in high school when I was teaching is I would ask the class, for instance, down the road from the school, the last school I was at, there was a Piggly Wiggly. And I'd ask them, how much food is there in that Piggly Wiggly to sustain this community if we had some catastrophic incident that cut off all the roads and we were not able to get shipping in to this Piggly Wiggly for an extended period of time? How much food is in there? And you would hear them guess, well, there's a month, there's 3 weeks. And their face would fall off when I tell them there's approximately 2 days of worth of food in any given grocery store. They just couldn't fathom that. So I ask, what are you going to do on day five?
Fast.
I'm coming to your house. I'm going to take yours. I said, well, I hope you can dodge a silver bullet because you're not getting my beanie weenies. But
We've preached people should prepare for a long time just because it's the responsible thing to do.
Sure.
We've actually lost power for 7 days at a time up here in the mountains and been snowed in. You couldn't get a vehicle on a road anywhere. So we're always prepared. It doesn't mean a thing to us because we're used to that. But in the cities, it would be disastrous. And what we're really bankrupt in, and it's not the wheat or, you know, stockpiles of food. We used to have a joke when I would speak to people that we would sell them so many freeze-dried, you know, pounds of freeze-dried food for $10,000, or the economy model was, you know, 5 bags of grain and a grist mill. And the super economy model, for $5, I'll give you a list of all the Mormons in your area. And then I would say, if you really want to save money, look around and see who's not laughing. But the point is, what we've really lost is community. We don't. I was in an L.A. earthquake years ago, back, I don't know, it must have been 40-some years ago. The pipelines were broke, and we didn't have water in our area for days. And so I go down to the store, and it's just a panic. People are pushing each other around. There was a pool in our backyard, and we would loan out the water, give out the water that was in the pool so people could flush their toilets all over the neighborhood. There was one other pool in the neighborhood, and that guy protected it with a gun. And I thought that was insane. He wasn't going to let anybody have his pool water. That is the danger, is that we don't have a community anymore. We don't have each other. And whatever happens, you're going to need each other. And that's what brought the Christians through the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, which suffered all these same things: shortage of grain, runaway inflation. Half the people were on government dole, and government dole ceased. We're facing those same kinds of problems today. I don't know exactly when, but we're ill-prepared because we don't have community, and that's what churches should be building. We don't even have church buildings in our church network. Some people have some buildings they meet in, but we know the church is people, and so we're bringing people together. and we're bringing them together in small, intimate groups and connecting those groups all over the country. And that's what we need more than anything, because you're going to need other people who have that understanding, who care as much about your rights as they do their own.
I couldn't agree with you more. One of the very fortunate times in my life, my family and I spent approximately 5 years living in Turkey, and we lived and worked in the community. And obviously, Turkey is a Muslim country, 99.9% of the country Muslim. But we worked with what you would essentially call an underground church. They have no buildings, no pews, and very few had Bibles, but they were some of the strongest believers of the faith, because they had been tried by fire, and they depended on community. For instance, if you and I were part of this church community in whatever city, if I didn't hear from you on a regular basis, I mean almost daily, I would be over at your house finding out what was going on, because there's a very good possibility that you've either been arrested or that you've been kidnapped by possibly family members who want to do you harm. You know, there's just a whole host of things when you live in that type of environment. And so the people nurtured and took care of each other. And so we did that for about 5 years. And then I come back here to the States, and I'm in my mom and dad's hometown, and I'm with my wife and family. We're driving down Church Street, and there's 400 different church buildings all in about a two-mile stretch. And, you know, there's First Baptist and Lutheran and Pentecostal and Holiness and the Catholic Church and all these other churches. And I almost started to cry, because there was no life in those churches. And I think a lot of that was because they're not tested. There's no real need for them to be community, like you said. Now, there are some great churches, don't get me wrong, but a lot of it is what I consider is more of a Sunday morning social club than it is a group of people who are willing to share the pool water, you know,
right,
or share the biscuit,
yeah,
whatever it is that, you know, that you have. And I'm afraid that when whatever tragic event finally rolls around to collapse our system, you're right, we're not going to have people who are willing to share, and we're all going to, you know, a lot of people are going to be hoarded up in their little buildings trying to protect their pool water or their can of beanie weenies or whatever it is.
Right, and we have to change from that. And the more we do now, the better off we are. The healthier we will be in society. We believe that if you need anything, you should go to church, and not just sit there and pray about it, but you should together come together. You go into we have people in other countries, and some of the third world countries have this understanding better than we do, because there is no government benefits. There's only the church. And when you do that, you start creating bonds that you cannot create because of your eschatology or theology. You're creating bonds that will last generations. And this is something that we've learned over the years, that we've lost that in America. And unless you die in the pew, you could die in most churches and nobody would know about it, because you just didn't show up next week.
Well, in our churches, we
want to know.
One of the favorite things I heard a pastor say one time was the largest mission field that he ever encountered sat in a pew on a Sunday morning. And, you know, I think half of the people who heard him say it didn't catch what he was trying to say. But I'm really interested in this concept that you're talking about, the gospel of the kingdom. But I think I know what you're referring to. You know, we're not a building, we're not a denomination. We are a group of people who are following the same tenets and teachings of Jesus. How do we get the average Sunday morning church, you know, the local church around here, the biggest church is the Baptist church. How do we get the average Baptist church person who's, you know, living a fairly decent life and plugging along through society, how do we get them to start keying into these types of things?
Well, you know, that's the $64 million or billion-dollar question, depending on the inflationary term you want to use. We are struggling all the time trying to spread this gospel message of what the early church was doing, and that's why I wrote the book Thy Kingdom Comes, to show people what they were doing and why they were doing it. And most people don't have those kinds of ideas. They they don't know history. Most people don't know their American history. And if you, like you say, if you study the books after the 60s, or you can find the changes back in the 40s.
Sure.
They'll have a different view of those men and those events back then. I don't even like to use the word founding fathers, because the real founding fathers of America were all those unnamed fathers who stood up, and they didn't actually revolt. It was the king who was revolting. They considered themselves already free. And it was the unwarranted usurpations of the king that they just simply stood against and said, "We're not going to let you do this anymore because you're breaking the law." They'd come here and suffered and died and buried children and fathers and wives to become free people. They suffered the hard times, and I'm afraid most people in America are not going to wake up until they're hard times. But some people are, and you'll find it amongst people who are thinking homeschooling or home health and starting to think outside that box. And I think the more of those people that come together now and teach each other and learn what we have forgotten, the better off we'll be. A lot of other people will have to be learning rather quickly, kind of on the job training. But we need to get back to what we once were, that character and virtue that once was in our societies that we've gotten away from. And that's the message that's the thing that we keep repeating over and over again.
Well, yeah, as I read it, and obviously I'm not the scholar that you are, but when I read my Bible and I read the book of Acts and the letters that Paul wrote and others, I see a community of people who were under, you know, some serious times, and by and large they were doing what you're talking about. If a family had a need, they met the need. But they also were very strict with discipline in the body as well. And Paul was very good at calling you out and saying, you know, you guys need to correct this problem here. But I don't know. I've had such a time since we come back from Turkey with finding a community of believers that was willing to accept this community philosophy and to be able to help. I can remember years ago when I was working in a very small church setting, if someone said, you know, I'm having problems with my car, someone else in that church community would almost immediately stand up and say, well, I'm a mechanic and I'm willing to help. But today, everybody just looks around and kind of shakes their head and says, well, maybe we can help you out, maybe we can't.
Well, actually, what you hear...
We're not willing to sacrifice anyone.
You hear way too often that people will say, well, let's pray for his car.
Well, you can pray for my car all day long. You can even anoint it with WD-40, but I'm not sure if it's
going to work. Well, WD-40 might help, but the point is that we need, faith is an action word. Love is an action word. It's not something you just feel and then go back home and turn on the TV. You have to get involved in each other's lives. When I was back there in North Dakota, I stayed with my grandmother and helped out my uncle on the farm, and my grandmother had pretty much gone blind. I looked in the milk carton she had in the refrigerator, and the milk was the wrong color. There was the red in it. And I didn't know if she put tomato juice in it or it came that way from the store, because she was very thrifty, having gone through the Depression. So I took it back to the store, and I told the guy at the store, you know, this milk looks red in there. Is all the milk that way, or did my grandmother pour something in it she shouldn't have? And he says, well, here, take another milk carton. I said, well, I'm not trying to get another milk carton. I just want to make sure if it's contaminated that you knew about it. And he says, no, you take milk carton. And you take two, you know, kind of thing. And I said, well, I'm not trying to get that. And he says, look, during the Depression, we carried a lot of people in our community who could not pay their store bill. And we carried them through the winters. And he says, Anton, which was her husband back then, he had passed away since. I never ever met him, but he's the only one who came back and paid that bill up full of all the people in the community. And he says, if she needs anything, she can have it. Now, this guy was maybe not even alive during the Depression. He was a young guy. But he knew this from his father and his grandfather who had run the same store. And to him, this woman was never going to go hungry, never going to go without milk if he had milk, because the husband had done a favor way back years and years before. These ties go way beyond contracts, way beyond welfare. And I can guarantee you, Safeway's not going to carry you through the Depression. We've lost that interpersonal touch that we used to have everywhere in communities where people helped each other out. And so that's what churches should be cultivating, and worrying less about how on key the choir is and more on how on point we are in our virtue and in the way in which we handle each other. You know, shaking each other's hand for a brief moment within the churches, or clapping each other on the back, or smiling at each other isn't going to get us through hard times. Now, there's some great people out there in churches today, but we're completely untested, and we need to start to repent and turn around. And when they asked the difference between the kingdom of heaven that John the Baptist was preaching, and most people don't know this, but Herod had been preaching the kingdom of heaven too, but he had a different version of it. He called it the kingdom of heaven. You could actually get baptized by Herod's ministers as he sent them out. And John was also baptizing, but they had two different ways in approaching. If you signed up with Herod, you had to pay in, and he would take care of your social welfare needs. They called it Corban. But if you got baptism of John the Baptist, they asked him, how does it work? He says, those amongst you who have two coats share with those who only have none. You know, have none. And that it's faith, hope, and charity. And that was the distinction between the two governmental systems.
If you were baptized by John the Baptist, weren't you thrown out of the basic Pharisee
eventually
community?
Yes, you were. If you got the baptism of Jesus Christ, there was a ruling that came down because so many people were following John and then followed Jesus, who came after John, that if you got the baptism of Jesus Christ, you were out of the welfare system that was run through the temple, which was a government building. People don't realize that that temple was the government building. The Sanhedrin was Congress. And if you got cast out, you didn't get any more government benefits. But that was okay, because Christ was putting in place a system that would carry them through all the depressions. We see it right away in Acts, where they talk about a dearth and where there was a shortage and a famine developing in an area. And those that had shared with those that didn't have. And it was a very well-organized system that operated on faith, hope, and charity and the perfect law of liberty, not on entitlements, because those entitlements were the same as they were in Egypt. What we've done, we have more in common with the Egyptian bondage and what the Pharisees were doing today than Christ and what the Christians were doing. And we need to get back. We need to find out what he was doing, and we need to get back to that. And that's what we're trying to show people how to do.
I agree. And unfortunately, I think it's going to come to some major tragedy that's going to take place. One of the favorite stories I read was about Corrie Ten Boom, and she was visiting a college. I guess it was a religious college or a Christian college, and there was a whole host of young people who were there listening, and she spoke to them for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then she decided to take questions. And one of the young people stood up and asked her, what do you pray for on a regular basis? And she stopped for a minute before she answered, and she kind of mused to herself, and then she approached a microphone, and she said, I pray that this nation come under intense persecution. And you could just hear the wind get sucked out of the room. You know, oh my gosh, what are you talking about? She said, until persecution comes, until we're tested, we'll never know how strong we really are. And you young people have not been tested. And I think that's what we're kind of talking about here, is we have become a soft nation. We've become a nation that depends on Uncle Sam, our government. The great example of that is a video. I wish I had thought about it earlier, but there's the video of the young lady down just after Katrina. She's standing in front of the football stadium there, where all these people are being waiting on the government to come rescue them. And the TV crew says, what do you think? And she says, who's going to pay my bills now? You know, I mean, lady, I think there's more important issues going on here. Or the other video from the people who were thinking that with the new administration coming in, they wouldn't have to make a house payment anymore. You know, that
right.
The government was just going to pay for houses and stuff. And so that's the mindset that a lot of our communities are in. It's unfortunate, and I think there's a ton of different reasons why that's come about. I think part of it is the name it, claim it type of theology that I see so often on late television, but it will come to a tragic event. It will come to persecution. It will come to this country being shaken literally before we get back on our knees again. And it's encouraging to know, and you spoke about there, that you are working with people and you are seeing evidence of many people coming back to the gospel of the kingdom and community sharing and things like that. And it's just refreshing to know that there are people out there who are spreading this word and that we're coming up right up to the end of our program. So let me go ahead and give you a website one more time. The website is www.hisholychurch.org, all one word, HISHOLYCHURCH.org. There's some fascinating reading there and some great information. And Brother Gregory, it's been a pleasure, and I'd love to have you come back again sometime. And we can there's a whole host of topics we can play with, but it's been a pleasure talking to you. And,
it's been a pleasure being here.
All right. Well, this is Paul Revere Radio, and once again, we spent an hour talking about the pressing issues of the day and some absolutely fascinating conversation with Brother Gregory. I encourage you to go to his website. And until then, we want to shine our lanterns in our window. It's one if by land, two if by sea, and three if by government. And I think I'm still going to hang three lanterns in my window. God bless you, everybody, and have a good evening.
From the mind.